I'm Jeannie.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Nikki from Tyrion's Landing,
a podcast member of the Gonna Geek Network,
just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in...
3, 2, 1...
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 168 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we wish you a Merry Christmas with smiles on our faces, offer to fill an hour of your time with good cheer and a little bit of lighthearted fun, and then flip the tables and broadside you with an emotional realization that leaves you gutted and sobbing into the remains of your holiday cookies and torn wrapping paper. Fa la frickin' la. I'm your host, Haley, and with me today in the GPR studios, we have Jay. How are you today, Jay?
I'm so very sorry that I have asked for this for so long.
And how are you today? We also have Keir. How are you today?
I am here, and yes, I am also here, and pleased to be here.
How are you?
That's good. Much good. How?
Everything's fine here now. How are you?
You can just move along. Well, this week we are treated to three stories in a single Christmas special episode. We get an RTD-like sort of silly adventure complete with giant robots and blustering warlords. Then we get a comedy of errors with a mistaken identity and a pretty sizable wink from our main character. And then we also get a most unexpected and heartrending closure of what could be the most improbable love story ever to be scattered across the universe. So after all is said and done in The Husbands of River Song, you can't really be sure if you're exhausted from laughing or from the tears. It's perhaps a bit of both, so...
Probably both.
Yeah.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, but I think all in all, I think if we take our knee-jerk initial reactions, are we all of a single mind on how this turned out?
I think so.
I liked it.
I was happy with it. Is it the best Christmas special we got? No, but it was still highly enjoyable.
Okay, I'll start there then. You say it's not the best Christmas special. What do you still consider topping your list?
I will always have a special place in my heart for Christmas Carol. I think that one was the perfect blend of comedy, of lighthearted fun, seriousness, of just all-out Christmassy feelings. The parental abuse of the child was maybe a little bit dark for a Christmas special, but who doesn't get a little bit drunk and smack their kids around for being noisy?
That's Jay at GallifreyPublicRadio.com. I will say, though, although using your same arguments, that's why I'm seriously considering this to be my favorite Christmas episode. And there's one asterisk hanging off the end of that, but I mean, as far as the elements of humor, as far as the tightness of the dialogue and character interexchanges, the emotional journey that's taken, and the unexpectedness of the depth of the story that we get when we transition from Act One to Act Two is exceptional. I would say the only thing that makes this undoubtedly the perfect Christmas episode is that it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with Christmas at all.
Yeah, it's just the fact that they wind up on the planet for Christmas. Like, that's when you got the reservations, was for Christmas Day. And right. River has a slightly Mrs. Santa Claus robe on when we first see her.
Yeah, totally Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Saucer crashed in the snow. Oh, that, is that
It was
new?
Red. It looked like a big giant Christmas ornament.
It did. Yeah. Well, okay, but... And Haley, where would you, as far as stacking Christmas episodes, knowing what you know, how you feel about the ones we've received of late?
Yeah, This is definitely top tier. I don't know if it's the best. I would probably have to rewatch a couple of the other ones. But I would say the only ones that could even compete would be, you know, Christmas Carol and The Snowman. Because a lot of the other ones are pretty spotty.
Okay.
But this one I really like.
We mentioned in the intro that this had, at least at the outset, a very RTD feel to it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, is that fair to say? Do we just randomly call anything that is lighthearted and goofball an RTD similar episode anymore?
Well, by historic pattern, the majority of them were his craft, his take, what he wanted from the tone and the walk away from the show was to be something still remained family oriented, kids sitting on the couch with the parents enjoying the episode for a lot of the same reasons. And there weren't, while we criticize Moffat a lot now for taking some detriment towards consequences and things with RTD, 8 times out of 10, you knew there weren't going to be any consequences because it was just this side of goofery. Mm. And Hydroflax is just this side of goofery.
He's just the other side of goofery, let's be honest.
Yeah. But really enjoyable.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked him. He was just this big, blowhard, you know, relatively powerless, but talked a great game.
This was one of those episodes that you can't go into taking seriously. Like, you're not going to go into this wanting a deep story. You're just, if you go into this thinking that you're going to get, like, another Heaven Sent, then, yeah, you're going to be highly disappointed. You have to go into it knowing that it's just supposed to be a fun ride. This is your popcorn movie. You know, mm-hmm. You get all of your Oscar contenders out of the way, and then this is your summer blockbuster Independence Day sequel that you know is just going to be fun, but you're not really expecting anything from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you go in expecting, you know, fun and popcorn, and then you get hit by the emotional bus at the end. Right. Good times.
And we'll definitely get to that. I wanted to take a kind of a look, though, at this whole idea of this valuable diamond embedded in the head of a headless king, you know, and all of the jokes that go along with this. You can't shoot a head in the face. I mean, from a dialogue standpoint and just having some fun with it, and we're going to get to what I consider to be some of the most fun aspects of the entire episode. But just looking at the big finger quotes problem here, mm-hmm. of River trying to pull this diamond caper by marrying into this blowhard and basically ready to off him at a moment's notice to run off with the jewels. So, I mean, very light on the science, no hang-ups, you know, no repercussions of ever having to deal with Hydroflax or any of his minions, although Scratch was pretty cool, you know, to ever see them again, mm-hmm. in another episode. Just kind of fun in and of itself, even before we get to some of the emotional topsy-turvy that plays in later. It was a really, just right out of the can, fun story to begin with. The mistaken identity bit about the doctor versus the surgeon. Even before River comes into it, but just all the little plays on, you know, what kind of a doctor are you again? You know, and he's kind of fumbling his way through it. That had such a classic feel to it of the doctor just saying, oh, sure, I'm supposed to be here. Who did you need? That's me. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's happened a dozen times. And that was fun because it's not necessarily the fact that he's trying to insinuate himself into a situation. It's just, you know, the guy comes up. He's clearly a little bit, you know, lacking in the brain department. And it's like, are you the surgeon? He's like, yeah, close enough. Like, you know, it's, he's assuming that he's being looked for at this point, you know.
Yeah. Something in the translation, you know, surgeon, doctor didn't quite work out the same. Now, as far as Nardole. You know, and Matt Lucas as one of their guest stars. You know, Matt Lucas, if anyone's familiar with Little Britain and seeing work there, and all of his character work. Simple fun, but I kind of feel, and I love Matt Lucas. You know, I'm a big fan of Little Britain and all of their sketch comedy work. But I think anyone really could have played this role. I'm not so sure that there was something magical or unique to Lucas's particular performance with it, other than just being this kind of sad sack minion.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I mean, he was fun in it. He was an enjoyable addition to the episode. But yeah, I don't think that it's anything that's, you know, inherently him that made it that way. Mm.
Now, when we take our mistaken identity issue, that this sort of, you know, Shakespearean comedy of errors going on here, and now we get River used to the mix, then the fun factor, you know, escalates exponentially because we're dealing with all of these instances where the doctor is just standing there without outright saying it, and he could have at any point.
Yeah.
But he decides to kind of play along because he figures, you know, either she's playing along, mm-hmm. and he's just waiting for the reveal, or there's something more to this. And he's fishing. And it's so much fun from our perspective, knowing what he's gunning for and just not getting it.
Yeah. Though, I mean, it was kind of fun, like, when he makes the switch, instead of, yeah, at first it seems like he's like, okay, do you seriously not know me? Like, come on, you're, like...
You're messing with me, right?
Admit to it. Yeah, he thinks that she's playing at something, or he's, like, waiting for it to register, and then he realizes, holy crap, she really doesn't know me, and then he starts having fun with it.
Yeah.
And that transition was so great.
It was. I think, and it's, I was saying, when we get to the point where he realizes that nothing he's saying or doing is causing the penny to drop, so he may as well just play along while there's no risk, no harm, no foul.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through the roof with it. His exposure to the interior of the TARDIS is one of the funniest things I've seen from Capaldi yet this program.
Oh, that was so great.
And the way that he could just... You watch him visually. His facial expressions through this episode were phenomenal on all levels. You know, we'll get to some of the stuff towards the end of the episode where he absolutely kills it. But as Haley was saying, when he's at the seriously kind of phase of things, you know, she's walking past him and he's just not getting the point across and he's just left there with his hands in the air, kind of, you know, it's phenomenal stuff from him. I almost wish that we were getting more from Alex Kingston match what he was putting into those initial scenes. It felt almost a little lopsided.
I almost felt like this was a younger version of River than we were getting at the end. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was a little concerned with the fact that in whatever had transpired for her chronology prior to this crossing of paths, however long since the last... their last dance, so to speak. She descended from being just, you know, this side of danger-esque into being an outright criminal. Like, there was no... I mean, she was meeting with this gathering of... how are they being described? They were in order to even be... It was where genocide decides to kick back and relax. These were the company she was keeping at this point. You know, she thought nothing of murdering the king and so forth. It's just... It got a lot darker for River.
I don't know. It felt more like it was... She was used to these people. She was used to this kind of lifestyle, but it's not something that she readily engaged in anymore. Like, this was a part of her past. This is something that she had dealt with previously, and she knew that, you know, this was just where she was going to get the best price, so might as well show up there. It wasn't necessarily that this is a part of the world that she's, you know, a part of anymore, but... Yeah, it is something that she has dealt with in the past.
Okay. I was kind of getting the impression that, similarly to, you know, we talk about the worry when the Doctor travels alone for too long and how he goes dark.
Mm-hmm.
If a long time had transpired since the last time River and the Doctor had crossed paths and she was without his contact for a while, does she go dark? And, you know, and when she's talking about, you know, especially when they get down to the point where they're standing in front of Fleming and Scratch and all of them, they're having the big showdown in the ballroom there, and she really starts laying it out in the line and starts throwing all these jabs at relationships and, you know, and what, who loved who or didn't love who, and you could tell she was really jaded at this point. And I'm wondering if that just says something about in a writer's mind that she has reached a point where the one thing that she held most near and dear, she feels, has failed her. He's sort of a fond memory at this point, or kind of an inspiration insofar as, well, he set me on this path, but it's my path now.
Yeah.
And that might be why she's gone as far as she has into this criminal life. She's no longer just kind of sneaky or mysterious. She's an outright criminal and potential murderer.
I think by this point, let's be honest, she's an actual murderer.
We'll give her that one as written. So when we get to the, just to kind of close things on the whole Hydroflax plot line, we were saying how, you know, everything there didn't, not really particularly consequential, but it moved the story along nicely. It gave a lot of fodder for some great one-liners. And then the solution to that one, if you want to kind of see it as such, was the whole, I'm going to call it the bank ball solution, you know. And I looked at that and I thought, you know what? As goofy as that is, we've seen a lot goofier. I'll accept that because it didn't require a whole lot of explanation.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, bank firewalls. Sure. I'm going to hook that up to this sentient cyborg here and it's going to blow his fuses. Got it. I took it.
Yep. Very Doctor Who solution to a problem. Yeah. That I was fine with. Seeing the guy fish it out of his own skull, that part I could have gone without.
When he like goes to put it in her hand and there's like goop still stuck. I know. And you see it stretch.
She receives it with a napkin and starts to wipe it down. Yeah.
Oh, but the sound effects for that were just, oh, when he's like peeling
as
his head.
As someone who has been handed wet money before.
Sweat dollars will not be accepted.
We will not accept money from socks or bras. Thank you.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, and am I wrong? I made this, I thought this was going on when I first saw the trailer, but the actor, I have not looked him up to see who actually played Scratch, but that kid looks so much like John Sim, it's creepy. His facial characteristics and his grimace look so much like Sim, it could be a sibling or a, you know, some sort of close family member. Really, really, I'll put a side-by-side out there and let people judge, because I was obviously very quickly proven wrong when I thought it might have been John Sim when the trailer flew by, but damn. I'm not sure what I thought about having the whole restaurant full of scratches.
Yeah, because shouldn't somebody have noticed as they were walking past?
Mm. Yeah. Or the hissing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that reminded me a bit of our buddy...
Colony Sarf.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too. I'm like, are these guys like tied in with that? Or is that... How's this working out? I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big universe. A lot of things hiss.
It's one of the easiest ways to communicate. To require a lot of breath.
Conveys a lot of information.
Point gets crossed rather effectively, yeah.
So then our, you know, it's right at that moment, it's during that altercation that the two acts shift and we start to get this very slow wounding process from River, where she shares quite a bit of information with anybody with an earshot about breaking down how she genuinely feels about relationships and her connection with this Time Lord and the Doctor. And it's really difficult to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't see Capaldi's, you know, just slightly over her shoulder. In fact, it may be more difficult seeing him in realizing what she has, you know, where she's come to without him there.
Yeah. And that was the thing too, when she starts going off and you're just like, oh, River, stop. Just stop. It hurts.
It's quite a bit of it. I think for a lot of reasons through the episode, for one reason or another, we're like trying to, you do the yell at the screen thing. He's right there.
Yeah.
It's the Dora. Where's my backpack? It's right there.
And like he's in the back raising his finger and stuff, like trying to interrupt without saying anything. Like, excuse me, pardon me, ma'am, excuse me.
But that's, I absolutely love, I could not credit them enough. Kingston, Capaldi, the production team, from when she gets down to the final moment and delivers her last line about if you really thought that he'd be here and so forth, and she looks over and he gives the slightest smile, like just this tiny turn of the corners of his mouth before he says, "Hello, sweetie," and you know she kind of rocks back on her heels a little bit,
yeah,
and then as she starts reasoning through and the realization starts to come in, his grin gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And just watching him for that 90 seconds or so is absolutely magical. You know, you get the goosebumps because it's so much feels.
Yeah, and then the exchange between them right after he says, "Hello, sweetie," and you know, you've got all that that plays out, and then the first thing she says to him is, "You are so doing those roots," and the grin on his face, and he goes, "What, the roots of a sunset?"
The roots of a sunset.
It was just so brilliant.
I think, you know, as we get to, we need then that storyline to progress a little bit. So, you know, the crashing of the ship and their bickering. Love their bickering, mm-hmm. going back and forth. I crash spaceships, it's what I do. I do it better, and on and on. Or the tricking each other into the TARDIS. They just keep busting through the doors like a farce. Perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it's an entire set of farce with only one set of doors. Because a door keeps moving.
Exactly.
Just shows at that point that everybody's enjoying this to the fullest. They're just having a blast with it, just even though they have to do the shaky camera crashing ship bit.
Yeah. And it's great. I mean, we kept saying how much we wanted to see Alex Kingston and Peter Capaldi on screen together. And this was everything I could have hoped for. Like, I mean, aside from length, but yeah, you know, that's neither here nor there. It was just, it was fun. It was the two of them playing off each other. Once they were both on equal footing and knew who the other one was, it was everything I could have hoped for.
Yeah. Now, when we get to the point where he has to, And again, it's these little details about him just advancing the TARDIS a little bit. You know, ship crashes, he looks out, burning wreckage, goes in, one button, one quick lever pull, looks out again. Okay, wreckage is cooled, you know. And they get to enjoy these little moments. I think, again, I'm glad that they didn't belabor the dialogue too much. Like, you know, he's talking to the guy, gives him a diamond, tells him, hey, restaurant, remember, restaurant,
yeah,
so forth. Doesn't really need a whole lot of explanation. I'd rather spend the time seeing him in his reflective moments, or letting he and River have their just their quiet looks, things. Not to say that the dialogue wasn't tight, yeah, but I think the episode was just as effective for the non-spoken.
The one thing I do have to say that, I mean, Douglas McKinnon did a fantastic job as director on this one. The scene you were just talking about with the when the doctor looks out the door and sees the burning wreckage, walks back to the console and does the thing and then walks back. That was all one take. That was all a continuous take from and it was just, it doesn't seem that way. Like, it seems like, I mean, it makes perfect sense. But when you think about how they did that as a production, it's like, wow, that's impressive. That's a bold choice, but it worked so brilliantly.
Hmm. The fact that you can do something like that and it can go unnoticed is actually a testament to how well it's done. Because if you try to pull that off and it doesn't work quite right, then that's what really catches the viewer's attention. I know I personally, because I look for technical details, so if I see a long take like that and I don't catch it until the second rewatch and realize, oh crap, they didn't actually break camera. They didn't even flip the dolly on that one. They just pulled back.
Yeah.
So that's impressive work. Well, then we get to, well, what broke all of us.
Yeah. And it was the moment when, you know, when he first starts talking about the restaurant and everything like that, I was like, okay, that's not too bad. And then he jumps back in the TARDIS and comes back out and asks for a reservation. I was like, oh, I know where this is going now. Dang it. And it starts to build. And you're hoping that you're wrong. And then you see him with the box, with the present. And as soon as I saw the present, just tears. And I didn't stop.
Well, did you notice at the very beginning of the episode when he went to her, when they were talking and she didn't know who he was yet, he said, I've had a haircut. This is my best suit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A little foreshadowing.
I did catch that on the on the next watch, but I didn't the first time. I was just kind of like, okay, it's, you know, yes, he's playing along, it's whatever it is. But no, it was when I saw him standing there with the box, it's like I knew it was coming before then, but that did me in.
It's interesting to note how through a lot of these aspects of it, even though River had some understanding of what could potentially be going on, you know, because the moment she saw that it was Deryllium that they were crashing on, you know, the moment she started mentioning to him about the Singing Towers, and you knew that she was somehow privy to the stories that she later mentions.
Mm-hmm.
But she goes along with it anyway. You know, the fact that she realizes why he's been canceling so often on this dinner date, so to speak, and yet she still goes to meet him there at the table. She realizes, okay, this is here, this is now. This is what has to take place. As much as she's dreading it, she's seeing it through because she somewhere thinks that there's a loophole that's going to be sought.
Yeah, but
you would think if anyone kind of understands, you know, the certain immutable aspects of time as well as the doctor, that she would. But then again, she's a rule breaker.
Right. Well, and he also just showed up with an extra regeneration.
Yeah.
So if there's any time to break rules.
Yeah. How did he explain it?
A thing happened.
Said, you know, I thought you were out of them or something.
A thing happened. Yeah. I think is what he said.
I'm sure it was a good thing.
that was great though, and I just that whole ending was beautiful, and I, as much as I clamored for that, as much as I kept saying I want to see that date, I want to see him give her the screwdriver, I want to see that. Once it happened, I was a mess, and I was like, why did I want this? This is awful.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts so good.
The expressions to one another, the demonstrations of their devotion to one another, as unusual as it was through the episode, but as it really starts to solidify in these final scenes, are kind of what I've been craving all along from the River storyline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gets down to the real core of their relationship, you know, the occasional bickering, the shared jokes, the sacrifices that they make for one another on a moment-by-moment basis or on a long pl- planned basis that prove a connection between them that I know that realistically the Tennant-Kingston pairing couldn't do that. It right. wasn't the right time to have that kind of bond
mm-hmm.
because Tennant was new to the relationship, as awkward as it was.
Yeah.
And I don't really think that Smith and Kingston ever got that quite right. Even though we were seeing them midstream through their relationship, it never felt right. And I don't know if it was a chemistry thing.
I think it was just knowing the age of the actors that just kind of threw it off. Like okay. maybe it was between them, or maybe it was just viewing as an audience. But it just, you couldn't look at them and say, this is an old married couple. This is a couple that has been through, you know, decades of experiences together and have this history. It's just, it didn't click.
Well, and there was also the fact that through most of their story together that we actually saw, they didn't have any shared experiences
mm-hmm.
because they were doing the whole back to front storyline.
Mm-hmm. And I always felt to a certain degree that Smith was always, well, at least the way Smith was portraying the Doctor, that he was always rather afraid of River.
Yeah.
They were not on equal footing. They were not at even keel in their relationship. He kind of reacted to her and dealt with the repercussions of her.
Well, let's look at what their dynamic was. Either she knew more than he did, which bothers the Doctor, and he can't stand that. He's always the cleverest one in the room, so somebody else knowing more than he does just doesn't sit well. Or he knew more than she did, and she didn't have the experiences to temper her, and she was a little bit, well, psycho. So
petulant.
Sure. Let's go ahead and...
We'll go with petulant. But here we have something where they are both fully aware of where they are in their relationship.
After a time.
Crisscross. Yeah. They have expressed insofar as they are capable, either through words or through their own demonstrations, they're aware of where they stand in each other's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
She says it outright. It's like being at your own funeral. You get to hear everything said about you. So he gets to hear her expressing how much she cares about him, thinking he's not in the room. So he's gotten that side of it, and then he's able to convey his reciprocated emotions simply by the fact that, well, despite what you think, I am here right now mm-hmm. when needed. So that that's his side of that expression of love. So I'm so pleased that the moments, that of all the moments that Kingston and Capaldi were given together, that this final scene was given the opportunity to take a time and have its spoken moments and its quiet moments and so forth. Because when you get down to his final, you're listening to this gorgeous score in the background. Murray's work is absolutely amazing for this one.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it doesn't feel particularly Christmassy, but that's not his fault. That's, no. that's what the script does. But all through, the singing towers scene, and you're not really sure which parts of the music are supposed to be the towers and which part is right. just the score going on in the background, whether you're supposed to know. But it's all done in these very heavy, very melancholy minor keys until he finally says the words 24 years, and the whole theme that's playing resolves on a major chord as she, kind yeah. of, I hate you thing, kind of throws that out. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And if you weren't weeping at that point...
Oh, yeah. No, that gets you.
Absolutely. You know, in fact, I might have been kind of recovering a little bit, and that just pulled the bottom of the barrel out of it.
You know what it is about this episode that bothers me so much? The main reason why I can't say that this is my favorite episode or Christmas special is simply the fact that we get both... we find out that this is the first time that River has encountered anyone after Smith. Like... This is her first introduction to the fact that the Doctor has more regenerations. So this is clearly the first time she's ever encountered any of the Doctors past Smith. And this is also the last encounter right before she dies. So it basically closed the loop itself, and you can't have River come back again.
Yeah.
Except you could have computer ghost River.
Yeah, but that's cheating.
I would argue that would be the biggest mistake they could yes. possibly
yeah,
make.
Yeah, very much so.
And you could put her in an android body.
Just her hair. Robotic hair. No, because it's... Yeah, and that kind of occurred to me, too. I mean, the moment the credits rolled, we kind of looked around and said, well, that's it.
Yeah, that really is it.
It's funny that just within the same week, Big Finish released their Diary of River Song, the first four-episode installment of what that series is going. And that works out fine because that's her escapades
before, in between, earlier
doctors. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's very different not being televised even now, because now, okay, we're walking through her diary.
Yeah.
Which has always been this revered thing, you know, her dirty little stories that she can go back and reflect on later. So, but yeah, you couldn't have her on screen.
No. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit before with the name of the doctor. When, you know, she's there as the computer ghost River and, you know, her final line is goodbye, sweetie. And we've talked about, you know, is this the end of River Song? Are we going to see her again? And I think we all kind of agreed that that could have been a good exit. That was, you know, it wrapped it up nicely enough that we were all okay with it if that was the last that we got. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling a little bit apprehensive, thinking if they bring her back, it has the potential to undermine that and be very bad. I feel like this avoided that. I feel like this was a worthy reason to bring her back. This was a good story to bring her back for, and then it, you know, it solidified that ending. It didn't say, it didn't give this nebulous, well, she might come back at some point. No, she's done. This is River Song's story, complete and whole, and it felt good to have that. It wasn't, you know, it didn't feel like it was a cheaper version of what we had in Name of the Doctor just for the sake of bringing her back. It felt like it kind of added to the story and made it all complete.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is the only piece of the River Song arc that could have been put in because it had such a monolithic importance.
Mm-hmm.
It was referenced the moment we meet her. We're already hearing about their final time together, and it had been given years to sit in the back of our minds. And God, how did she get screwed up?
Yeah.
How did he endear herself so much to her over the course of a bizarre, you know, cross-temporal relationship? And something like this, where you're given that, you know, you look at where they are with one another in those final moments, and you're thinking, God, they still have a lot of things they need to work out. You know, their relationship is still very spiky at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they both have some anger issues and things that still need to be resolved.
Control issues.
Yeah. But they've got now 24 years to be able to work that through, which makes the River Song of Silence and Library and Forest of the Dead make so much more sense.
Yeah.
Not that it didn't before, but now it means that much more.
Right, because up to that point, the relationship, they'd been bouncing around in each other's timeline. This is the first time they've had, as far as we know, where they've had an extended period of time where they were just together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Julie actually brought this up. When they first meet in the restaurant, she gives him a kiss on both cheeks. And I thought, okay, that's kind of unusual. I guess they're still kind of, you know, they're still slightly bickering a little bit, or she's still not sure how she feels because of fighting as they're crashing the ship or whatever the case. Or he left her unconscious on the floor of the TARDIS and, you know, that's kind of rude. Couldn't even give her a pillow. So, but then after they have the whole speech and we're just about to go to credits, they do not have a final kiss.
Yeah.
And Julie had actually noted that that's the best thing they could have done. Because it shows that they still have things to do. They have work to do on their relationship for the 24 years that we don't necessarily need to see.
Yeah, and I feel like at that point it almost wasn't necessary. Like it was almost implied that these two do love each other. We don't have to see them kiss in order to get that point across. They love each other and we get that. And there's no need to try and force it down our throat at that point. Just the look.
It might have felt a little heavy handed if they did. Yeah.
The look between the two of them, you know, just that knowing glance after he says, you know, after she's like, oh, I hate you. And he says, no, you don't. Just that the way that they gaze at each other. I mean, that sold it right there. You didn't need more than that.
Do you know, I actually saw some people criticizing the acting in this episode.
Yes, what? I did too.
I don't get it. But please, if anyone out there wants to explain, the only thing I could possibly get, because they were talking specifically about Capaldi and Kingston. I would have understood if they said, oh, well, you know, Matt Lucas's character is kind of goofy. Ramon was kind of a throwaway character. That's fine. Fleming. I liked Fleming.
Yeah,
he was delightfully oily, you know.
Deliciously evil.
But or even Hydroflax as this booming, you know,
comic
blowhard
book villain.
Yeah.
Precisely. You know. But to snipe at them to say that it was amateurish acting was one descriptor. or that it was a community theater quality. Really don't get it. I'm not really sure if they were just referring to a couple of lines that I just didn't pick up on or something. Because I think they hit some aspects of relationship chemistry that the River Song character had not been able to carry before.
Mm-hmm. I did hear from someone that they did not care for the point when they're laughing in the snow. You know, after they've stolen the head and they're sitting there in the snow and they're laughing, and somebody was like, it felt forced. It didn't feel genuine. And that's, I can understand that. I mean, at that point, it's who knows how many takes they've had to do. You know, who knows what's going on at that point. If they'd had a chance to play, to banter before, where it was in the shooting schedule. I mean, there's all kinds of things that could have gone into that. So, you know, an involuntary reaction like laughing, trying to catch that as genuine on screen is a very difficult thing to do. So I try to give that one a pass. I didn't really pay attention to it when I went back and watched it the second time, but I will the next time I watch it. But it wasn't enough to pull me out of it. You know, I just accepted it and moved on.
There's also the fact that, I mean, if the criticism was that the laughter was a little too boisterous, a little too over the top, you know, no one just busts out laughing like that. You also take into the fact if you come out of a perilous situation, you're coming off that adrenaline rush and things. Mm-hmm. Everything, all of your reactions, all of your emotional responses are a little bit out of whack because chemically, you're completely off your nut at the moment.
Right.
So you can do the, that's those moments when you get those wonderful laugh crying, which is always great. Because what's the matter? I don't know. So you could take it in any direction you wanted. So it didn't even register with me. I totally accepted it. I just want to know who Jim the Fish was.
Everyone knows Jim the Fish.
Everyone knows Jim. Except we all know us. Jim the Fish. Damn it.
We are the only ones who don't know Jim the Fish. What the?
I know.
That's the one story they never gave us.
I really want that to be like the conclusion of the Big Finish series. I want Jim the Fish story.
I could just see it now. Who's that guy over there? You don't want to talk to him. That's Jim the Fish. Everybody knows Jim the Fish. Somebody talking about me? Let me tell you my story. Opening credits. There we go. We're off to the races with Jim the Fish.
Let that be the cold open, and then they never reference him again.
Big Finish loves doing
that. So
we
finally did Jim the Fish. That was great.
Either that, or they come back like, you know, 12 seasons later, and they're like, and then I found his umbrella, and that's how I met Jim the Fish. And everybody the hates Fish. The
We're
entire
gonna how
series
I met your mother
for that.
As played by Stephen Fry, who apparently was an ex-husband of River Song.
I love the fact that they, you know, canonized Stephen Fry now. So if we ever do get an episode where he, you know, guest stars or, you know, writes, it brings like a whole new meta level to it.
Yeah.
Perfect. Like, you know, the doctor just like randomly meets Stephen Fry and just like he's glaring at him the whole time. What did I ever do to that guy? I don't know.
Did you guys notice that when they were panning the camera down through all the doctors, they skipped over 8? Like they went down to 7 and then they cut away and they came back and started at the war doctor.
I did not notice that.
Did they?
Yes.
Huh.
That's what I said.
Okay. Well, I was also wondering too, just about the fact that since Tennant's face was represented in the list there, now I want to go back and look at Forest of the Dead, Silence in the Library, and look for those hints of recognition from River in recognizing her damsel. Damsel, by the way. Come on!
Alright, so one thing I have to ask. One thing that's come up with a bunch of people I've heard from is that because this is the last doctor that she sees before meeting Tennant, her comment about, oh, you look so young, refers to, you know, David Tennant as a, you know, compared to face. Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, I don't buy that. She was looking into his eyes and saying, oh, he looks so young.
Okay, that was my feeling too, but then it's like some people brought that up and I'm like, I don't think that was what was intended to be portrayed there. And if that's what people are getting, I feel like they're missing out.
Yeah, I think that's an interpretation of what she's deciphering as young. Mm-hmm. But then there's also, you play around with the fact that if something that she sees in his eyes, she was staring into his eyes all through this episode as he was glaring back at her and she wasn't quite picking up on it. So maybe the 24 years that they get to spend in each other's company, she finally comes to understand her doctor.
She was distracted.
Just a bit.
She didn't really look into his eyes that much. She was busy doing things and talking.
Yes.
My only other thought, did you guys watch like the Last Night, First Night little mini episodes that I think they were on the season 6 DVDs bonus content?
I have seen them before.
Okay. Mm. So that had a Last Night on it. Is that supposed to be one of the dates that he ended up canceling?
I think so.
Or are we saying that, those just aren't canon?
I would say that they probably are canon. I mean, they're written by Stephen Moffat.
Okay.
I think that that's probably one of those things, because didn't she say, like, he's about to take me or something like that?
And I think so, yeah.
It was like they were on their way there, and...
And he had on the suit and the top hat, and...
Yeah, so I'm saying that that's probably one of the times... That's probably why Moffat put the line in about canceling it in this episode, is to kind of make up for that.
Okay. Because he's like, oh, wait, I've got a better idea.
Yeah.
I'm going to look and see if I have the transcripts from this well.
And it would have been Last Night. That's the one where they showed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that made it seem like they were on their way to the place and got sidetracked by some other adventure or something. Mm-hmm. So
we'll have to do a little extra research on.
Oh, also, we find out that River's been taking the TARDIS for joyrides.
He's never noticed before, and the Doctor's face is just kind of like, what?
Yeah, she rolled back the odometer with her finger. And
she came back in reverse.
Yeah. Right.
As long as she drives back in reverse.
Yeah, she put it up on cinder blocks, ran it in reverse for a little while.
Dad'll never notice. Yeah. Bow, bow.
Although I will say that Capaldi's reaction, like when she goes in and opens up the one roundel with the bar behind it, and, you know, she don't tell Dad kind of thing. It's the look on Capaldi's face, instead of being indignant or how dare you do this to my TARDIS or something like that, it's just a simple, like, how did I never know that was there? And that's exactly his Doctor, too. Like, he wouldn't be pissed off about it. He would just kind of be like, I should have known about this.
She knows more about the TARDIS than him.
Well, that's just the way that his mind operates. If he didn't put it there, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if it's not important to him, it gets deleted.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like the whatever on level 7.
Exactly. His one-liner about, oh, better stay clear of level 7 then.
It keeps venting the exhaust.
I loved the dialogue in this episode. It was so fantastic.
Because it's all done not only carefully walking through the canon minefield that Moffat himself is responsible for making as treacherous as it is, but it's also working with characters that he has crafted to be what they are. The 12th Doctor is his creation, his culmination, and everything that he's described, this is the Doctor that he's always wanted to have. So he's got that paired with this femme fatale who is also his creation, which, whatever it is that Moffat's trying to work through on this thing by creating characters like this, tell us about your mother, Mr. Moffat, is something where you can tell that he probably... This is another one of those instances where I see him sitting behind a laptop giggling as he's going through his edits. Oh, this is going to be so clever. They're going to love me and hate me once.
Yeah.
What did our peoples feel about the episode?
Well, we don't know what people on Facebook thought about it, because they were lazy this week. So, yeah. Calling you out.
You got to step up your game. You know, the Twitterers are killing you.
Yeah, we're keeping score, by the way.
Yeah, and Tumblr, you got a long way to go, pal.
So, our friend Mike from the Time Scoop podcast wrote to us and said, it was fun and moving. When the Doctor showed up with the Christmas gift, my heart shattered. Yeah, completely agree. That was the moment that everything just broke for me. I was a blubbering mess at that point. Then Ben got to us on Twitter and said, it was the perfect summation of a Christmas day. Happy, daft, and a drop of sadness.
More than a drop. God, that was a full shot. Shot in the chaser, I think.
Jonathan said, that was amazing. It was beautiful. It was hilarious. It was everything I wanted from a Christmas special. And then Nicole said, I like River with 11, but River with 12 equals magic. Also, smiling and laughing looks good on 12. More, please.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of the dazzling grin, dazzling, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which looks like he's about to bite your dog. These were far more genuine, and it's just great to see on him. Yeah,
yeah. And I mean, that was the thing, too, was that he was able to laugh and smile and everything without losing what made 12 12. Yeah, he's still got that edge to him, even when he's enjoying himself. And that's fantastic to see, because I was worried about that. I was worried that if we get a happier Doctor, that it's going to go more goofball or friendly or things like that. And it's I should have known better. Capaldi is a skilled enough actor that he can still keep that edge even when he's laughing.
And again, you know, we've said this through so many episodes for this series, and especially looking at this as the official unofficial close of this series, we've been handed just an amazing show. And whether the numbers reflect it or not, whether the overarching fan base recognizes it or not, this is a banner year, a banner season for Doctor Who, and one that people are going to use a basis for Paris for some time. And I think the Christmas episode is part of that because of everything that we're given. I know a lot of hubbub is going around right now because of the article that we referenced last week when they were talking about, you know, development of the set here, and Capaldi was also talking about the fact that, you know, I do have to be aware of the fact that eventually I'm going to have to walk away from the show, you know, and something you have to prepare yourself for. Well, the internet over the past week has been absolutely agog with saying, this is the end, Series 10, Capaldi walks away. Mm-hmm. Maybe he does. You know, honestly, we've had a fair number of them, but he's too talented of an actor to stand still for too long. He's proven it in the past, in his past roles, and he's got other things that he's going to want to take on after this. But right now, while he's here, while he's in this role, he's giving 100%.
Yeah.
So just enjoy it, rather than, you know, ringing the doomsday bell about when he's leaving.
But, you know, that's what the internet does.
Yeah. Why don't we just talk about when we're going to get our sonic screwdriver?
Yeah.
Because the more I see the thing used, the more complicated I realize this replica is going to be.
Although that's one thing that I was upset about was the fact that, like, we barely got anything from that this episode. Like, it was one quick use, although he still has the sonic shades.
Yes.
Yes.
So
apparently they're like Bluetooth synced or something.
I was going to say, is it like an iWatch or something where...
Oh, crap, this app's not compatible. I got to go over to the other
one. It's his wearable.
I'm happy about the fact that it was one quick use just to say, okay, yes, we still have it. But, you know, that was it. It was just while he was looking at something. It wasn't anything that was getting used too much, but... I wanted more of the screwdriver. I want to see this thing in action, dang it.
And I think what action we do get is going to be more back to basics, because I think Capaldi himself is going to be that one who's going to look at the script and say, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah,
this,
I think so.
No, this gadget doesn't do this. This is ridiculous. How am I holding up a stone wall? How does this work?
And why am I straining by doing that? It doesn't make any sense.
Use the force, Doctor.
Says Gimli. Oh.
While putting on the sorting hat. All right, so are we ready to jump into the news?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not much in the way of news this week.
It's almost like we're 10 months out from the start of the series.
Oh, God. Oh, it hurts. It hurts as much as it did last time. Well, we do have one really, you know, if you feel you've regained your composure since Christmas Day and you've got everything in lockdown, you've restocked your Kleenex supply and those things, head over to YouTube and watch the fan re-edit of the completion of River Song's timeline using the footage from the Husband River Song, so that as she's describing, you know, she's talking to handcuffed 10th Doctor and explaining about their last night together, it actually cuts to their last night together and hurts even more.
Yeah, and then, you know, he says, well, time can be rewritten. And she's like, no, you can't rewrite those days. And then it flashes to other moments.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I can't do it yet. I've been
haven't even watched it yet?
I haven't.
It's so good.
It is very good.
After getting hit by the emotions bus at the end of the episode, you need it to back over you.
Yeah, backs over you with both axles so the driver can lean out and go, you're right, mate. It's nothing.
I don't know. I know I'm going to have to sit and watch it, but I can't make myself do it just yet.
That's fair. Later tonight.
Yeah, it'll come.
When you're even more tired and emotional.
That's probably when I'll be like, no, it's a good idea now.
And then cry yourself to sleep
again. Another little bit of news, something that you might want to make note of, because it's all kind of happening very quickly through this week, in what would have normally been a very quiet news week for Doctor Who. had a chance earlier today, actually, to talk for about a half an hour or so with none other than Matthew Jacobs, co-producer and writer of the 1996 Doctor Who movie, and his co-director, Vanessa Yule, who have been going around to a lot of conventions here in the States, if you've seen them over the course of the past year or so, because they're putting together a documentary called Doctor Who Am I, which is less about the Doctor and more about the fan base, and specifically an American fan base, and how this iconic British program has become such a U.S. phenomenon. I'm sorry, I can't say the word without doing it. But they had some phenomenal insight to give into the production process of the documentary they're working on. The filming has completed, and now they're into the editing and post-production phase, which is the costly portion of the phase. So they've been running an Indiegogo fundraising campaign. Details will be on that post. So it's a separate episode, separate post on GallifreyPublicRadio.com. So please, please, please check that out and find out what you can about that documentary, because it's been interesting in what they've shared. I actually was able to ask a couple of rather pointed questions about what happened in the process of putting the 96 film together, and what didn't work, and what was and was not written. And Matthew was actually very, very accommodating and very candid about his answers with it, and actually said that in the final cut, the feature cut of the documentary, because all of the principal actors are in it as well. You know, Paul McGann is there, Daphne Ashbrook, E.G. So, and they're actually very candid as well about what didn't work with that, if you want to call it a failed backdoor pilot, so to speak, and where you can hold who accountable, whether it was Fox or Universal or the BBC or some combination of the three. Really interesting stuff. So please do check it out.
Yeah, definitely. And last thing here, if you have not had a chance yet, go check out our Patreon page. The links are in the show notes. It's also tagged into our contact information on the site. So you can go check that out. Look at our goals that we're hoping to achieve, and see which one you want to help us accomplish, and how much suffering you want to put us through.
I may want to actually edit that. I'm looking into, I've always wanted to make sure that I kept tabs on things like for a swag that we'd have for con handouts and stuff like that too. So I may chat with you kids about adding some of that into the mix for folks who make even the most marginal donations. So just want to be able to give people a little bit of a thank you back for what they do to help us improve over time. Yeah. So
right. Well, this has been episode 168 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, my entire understanding of physical space has been transformed. Three-dimensional Euclidean geometry has been torn up, thrown in the air, and snogged to death. My grasp of the universal constants of physical reality has been changed forever. Sorry, I've always wanted to see that done properly.
Where was the Scottish accent?
It sounds even funnier coming from a Texan. This is Kier saying, just a thought, you probably shouldn't do that in a restaurant.
And this is Haley saying, don't stop for strangers.
Works out so well for you.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.
After Dark, which won't last long because I'm exhausted.
Me too. I got to restack like 30 bags of 50-pound birdseed today. It was awesome.
Nice. Hey, I lugged around a 50-pound bag of birdseed today.
I took a nap today.
I did like 30 of them.
Yeah. You must have a lot of chickens. I only have the 6.
We do have quite a few birds out in the garden center.
Yeah, those ones that come swooping in and they nest up in the...
So have
that always freaks me out. I go to like Home Depot and stuff and I'm out in the trying to get cinder blocks or something and like there's these things swooping around.
Oh, we've got them in our grocery stores. Like no matter which one I go to, for some reason I always see birds in there.
Yeah. Well, like you see them out in the garden center and you're like, well, yeah, it makes sense. They're going up there, they're eating the bird seed. But then they go into other parts of the store, like over above the pharmacy and stuff, because that's right next to the garden center.
I think it was when I was flying back from Galley. Maybe it was Galley. It was one of my more recent trips. And I'm in the airport, I'm in the terminal, and there's a bird in the terminal, like in the gates, floating around. And as people are like passed out waiting for their next flight and stuff, and they're like sleeping across the seats and stuff, the bird's like landing on the armrests and things.
It's like, hopping around. Did he have to go through the TSA checkpoint? Did he go through the body scanner?
I highly doubt it. I think that
did he take off his little bird shoes?
Did I ever tell you guys about my senior prank?
Nope.
There were some great pranks that were pulled at my school. I will say that. But mine was mediocre at best, but the longevity is what makes it fantastic. So I went, and one day before the end of the school year, I stopped by the pet store before I went to school, and I got 20 finches, little tiny finches. And, you know, I got to school, loaded them all in my backpack, walked straight into the bathroom, unzipped my backpack, and let them all out, right? Birds flying all over the place. You know, it was chaos. Not a big deal. There were parts of my school that were still under construction that year.
Okay.
The birds nested in the roof. My younger brother, who graduated 5 years after I did, said there were still birds flying around when he was there. I recently spoke to one of my old teachers there, who I graduated in 2000. So, you know, let that date me. I think 2 years ago, I was talking to one of the teachers, and they're like, yeah, no, there's still birds that fly around. They get into the classrooms and cause all kinds of chaos. It's like, that was all me. That was all me.
Playing the long game.
I'm like, sure, nice. I didn't drop a cow into the senior courtyard, but, you know.
I think one of the best ones I had heard was the deconstructed beetle. Back when there was shop and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they took apart a Volkswagen Beetle and assembled it in one of the chemistry labs and left it running.
Oh, nice.
Like assembled it to the point where it ran and left it there idling. That's nice. Talent.
That's impressive.
Today.
Cool story, bro.
The overnight manager's car was parked next to the smoker's hut all night. We've had horrible storms and stuff all night long. The smoker's hut got picked up and blown into his car.
Ah.
Yeah.
Wait, what is this hut? Is this like just a usual kind of like a backdoor shed kind of thing?
It's like a carport, basically.
Oh, okay.
And the smokers go out there to smoke.
Oh.
So they've got shelter when there's horrible storms because, you know, they can't smoke anywhere near a building.
It'd be a hint that habits really got to go. But hey.
Yeah, no, seriously, go outside. It's 32 degrees, feels like 19, sleet and snow.
Mm-hmm. Best thing you could possibly do right now is light up. Go on. Well, if Jay's going to be able to play with all this editing later, so we'll leave everybody with these thoughts of a frozen Jay on your screen. And he'll suddenly like come back in, and we're both off the call. And he's like, and that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
That's the story of Jim the Fish.
And that's how everybody in my high school class knew Jim the Fish. All right. We'll see everybody next time.
Bye.
Bye.